Welcome back. I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. It's been quite a week for news. Yesterday's Supreme Court decision unexpectedly upheld the Affordable Care Act, with Chief Justice John Roberts siding with the majority in a 5-4 decision. Both CNN and Fox News reported that the act's individual mandate had been overturned before later correcting those mistakes. Earlier in the week, the court handed down a mixed decision regarding Arizona's SB 1070, which still allows officers to stop people if they have a reasonable suspicion the person is not in the country legally and ask them to prove their immigration status or citizenship. Jerry Brown signed California's $91.5 billion budget. It's actually larger than that when you include bond funds, and it's contingent on a November ballot measure to raise an additional $8 billion. The California budget includes deep cuts in social spending, mainly affecting the very poor. And Mexicans are going to the polls Sunday to elect a new president. We'll find out what's at stake in that election and how Mexicans are viewing the increasingly stringent immigration laws in places like Arizona. And joining us, we have Michael Doyle, who covers the Supreme Court for McClatchy, and he also writes the Suits and Sentences McClatchy Legal Affairs blog. Hi, Michael.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. Nice to have you with us.
Glad to be here.
We're also joined by Frank Contreras, who's an independent reporter based in Mexico. He reports for Al Jazeera English and has reported for NPR, the BBC, and the CBC, among others. Hi, Frank.
Hi, Holly. Good to be with you.
Good to have you. Later in the program, we'll hear from Valeria Fernandez, who is an independent journalist in Phoenix, Arizona, and she's co-producer of Two Americans. It's a documentary about Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio. So first off, as we always like to do on Fridays, let's go to both Michael and Frank and have each of you tell us about a piece of journalism this week that you thought was done especially well. Why don't we start with you, Michael?
I'd like to actually call attention to a body of work by an untraditional media organization, the Kaiser Family Foundation. Mm. They don't sound like a news organization, and they're not, but they have the most fantastically useful website concerning health reform and the health reform law. You can Google them at Kaiser Family Foundation. They have former reporters do impeccably researched and very clearly written stories examining the health law. They've got a fantastically easy-to-navigate website that enables you to track how the law is being implemented. It's just really fantastic journalism done by people who don't have the title of journalists.
Well, thank you for that, Michael. And we'll put a link to everything that you hear at yourcallradio.org. How about you, Frank?
Hi, yes. I'd like to draw your attention to reporting done by the London newspaper called The Guardian. Covering the Mexican election, they were able to do investigative reporting and get a hold of some documents coming from the major television network here called Televisa. And, of course, as you know, Televisa has been blamed for providing positive coverage of one candidate, the candidate who looks like he's going to become Mexico's next president, that's Enrique Peña Nieto, and also been blamed, the television network has been blamed for providing negative coverage of his main opposition candidate, the leftist candidate, Andrés Manuel López Obrador. And so the Guardian was able to get a hold of documents from inside Televisa's network that indicate that, in fact, this was taking place. In fact, the television network was receiving tremendous amounts of pay to be able to do the kind of positive coverage that has been broadcast across Mexico during this important campaign, and thus indicating that it actually was a policy of the company to provide positive coverage and then negative coverage of the leftist candidate. And so that was something that caught a lot of attention in Latin America and Europe, but I'm not sure many people in the United States heard about it.
Well, thanks for letting us know about that. Let's get into that a little bit more. What was the reaction inside of Mexico, and how is this influencing the race for the presidential campaign?
Well, the reaction on social media was tremendous. We saw this wave of back and forth texting messages, people talking about what the documents meant. As you know, this time the Mexican presidential election is got quite a special tone to it. It looks like there's a strong chance that the former party that governed Mexico for 71 consecutive years will return to power. That's the Institutional Revolutionary Party. And for many years, there's been a sense that the television networks here work hand in hand with the powers that be and basically help the elite decide who the next president will be. And so there's been one of the characteristics of this campaign, it's been very different this time around. It's been a growing student and youth movement that's been taking to the streets. They're called Yo Soy 132. It's a strange name, but it basically came from a protest that took place in one of the university campuses. And
what is the 132?
It's a strange thing to explain. Basically, the PRI presidential candidate went to a major university, which was a middle class, a wealthy university, a private university, and he was basically booed and forced to leave because the students said they don't want to see the return of his party or of the kind of unbalanced reporting that's been taking place on Televisa, according to these student protesters. And so the political candidate for the presidency of the PRI came out very quickly and said, no, these people are being paid off. This is not an authentic movement. And the very next day on YouTube, 131 students came forward and showed their student ID cards in videos saying, no, we are authentic. This is a very real grassroots movement saying no to political corruption and to cronyism and the kind of thing that's been taking place, they say, on the television network here. And so the PRI came out once again and said, well, look, that's 131 of them. That's not many. It's not a huge movement. And so the very next day the movement was born. The movement in English would be something like, I am number 132. And basically it's an indication that, you know, there are many more of us than you think, and we're out in the streets. And this time around the students and their movement, they've been able to create their own television because of social media and the ability to edit video fairly easily and broadcast it in high quality on the internet. And so they've been doing that and taking up you know, the banner of basically criticizing the PRI candidate and the television network here for the kind of coverage that it's done. So this has given a very different tone to the presidential campaign, one that we have not seen before. Some people are likening it to the Arab awakening, the so-called Arab Spring that took place in so many Arabic countries around the world, where you see people rising up and saying no to their political system.
Well,
something very similar is happening here, but anyway, this is one of the things that marks the difference here in this campaign.
Fascinating. Okay, so Frank, can you just go back though a little bit and tell us about the candidates? So currently, Enrique Calderon is of the PAN party is in power, and then you've got Peña Nieto, who's with the PRI, running for President. López Obrador, I think, is in second place, and he's with the PRD, and then running third is Josefina Vasquez, who's also of the PAN party. Tell us about these candidates and kind of give us a sketch of what's happened.
Well, presidents in Mexico are elected once every 6 years, and the Constitution says as president of Mexico, you cannot be reelected, and so there has to be an election to choose the next leader of Mexico. As you know, the country's been going through a very difficult problem with the drug-related violence that's been taking place. The numbers that we're hearing come to somewhere around 60,000 during the six-year period that President Felipe Calderón has been in office. He's the one who decided upon taking office to use the security forces to take on the drug trafficking cartels. And what we've seen basically is a splintering of those cartels and a rising number of people dying in drug-related violence. Many of them are innocent bystanders. A good number, though, the vast majority are people directly involved with organized crime. So the security issue is very important, along with the economy. As always, people are worried about rising poverty and inflation, their ability to make a living here. And so they're looking for a new leader who can bring the country forward. The polls that have been published in recent months indicate that the front runner, by at least double digits, according to these polls, is the candidate of the Institutional Revolutionary Party. His name is Enrique Peña Nieto. He's a telegenic, handsome, 40-something-ish year-old ex-governor of a major state here. And of course, you'll remember his party, the Institutional Revolutionary Party, known as the PRI or PRI in Mexico. That party ruled this country for 71 consecutive years at the presidency until it was beaten in the year 2000 by the now ruling National Action Party. And so people have this sense that if you want to go back to the old Mexico, you go back to that party, the PRI, but there are many others who definitely support this man and say that, sure, there's been corruption, there's been vote fraud under that party, but that is a party that is the most experienced in the country. It's the one that will get us out of the problems that we have now. So that begins to explain the polls here. There are many Mexicans, of course, who don't believe the polls. They believe that newspaper organizations that provide these polls to the public are somehow skewed. And so there's a lot of distrust taking place. In second place, and running a very close second, is the coalition leftist candidate. He's Andrés Manuel López Obrador. As you said, Holly, he represents the left-leaning Party of the Democratic Revolution. That's PRD. And they're the ones who've been governing the Mexican capital, where I'm speaking to you from Mexico City, for, well, since 1997, governing solidly here and basically creating a power base. López Obrador narrowly lost the last presidential election to Felipe Calderón by less than 1% of the entire vote. It was something like 0.56% of the vote was the difference between these two.
Yeah, and there were big protests, right?
Oh, it was major, yeah. I remember covering the story for public radio in the United States, and we saw, you know, hundreds of thousands of people out in the streets here in the Capitol saying that vote fraud had taken place. They were demanding a recount of every ballot, and that never took place. So López Obrador basically said it was a fraudulent election. He was
Frank?
Those acts of claiming to be the legitimate president and taking over the streets angered a lot of people. So those are the two front runners. And as you mentioned, Vázquez Mota, Josefina Vázquez Mota, a woman candidate for the ruling National Action Party, known as the PAN, is running a distant third.
And is the PAN doing so badly because of their war on drugs and drug cartels? Do you think that that's
been the perception, absolutely, that people see that the country doesn't appear to be advancing. In fact, with this number of deaths taking place, with the kind of presence of violence in very important regions of the country, especially on the border with the United States, there's a sense that it's sort of slipping out of the government's control. And so that's one of the reasons that you're seeing the National Action Party, the right-leaning National Action Party of President Calderón, falling far behind in the polls. And it appears that, you know, that the candidate will come in third place. And I think it largely has to do with the way people are viewing the drug war. And it seems to be something that just really hasn't helped the country very much at all. There's also major problems in the economy. People are feeling that, you know, with the global economic pressures that have been taking place in the United States, of course, Mexico's major export partner, that has created problems with the economy here. There's been a stagnation in the creation of jobs. You can get a job, but it's very low paying. And people blame all these things on the National Action Party, and that starts to explain why they're running a distant third.
And, you know, I had read, and I wanted to ask you about this, that under the PRI party, the PRI, there was sort of an unwritten agreement between the cartels and local governments that they would look the other way. Is that the way that it was, that there was a sort of detente in that sense? And how will this war on the cartels and the war among the cartels change under a new administration?
Well, it's important to look back at the flow of illegal drugs from Mexico to the north. It's been going on since the beginning of the last century. For more than 100 years, we've seen tremendous amounts of drugs going from Mexico into the United States. In many cases, it was opium. It was heroin poppies that were being grown along the Pacific coast, turned into opium and being sold in the United States, sometimes legally, actually, to help soldiers that were fighting in World War I, World War II, that sort of thing. But it turned into an illegal trade over the years. And there's a sense that that's just been going on in a very strong way. Of course, when the PRI governed for 71 years, there was a sense that that some sort of pact was created. And there are documents that show that, in fact, in some northern Mexican states along the border, Chihuahua State, just south of Texas, for example, that federal police officials were actually the ones who were deciding how the drugs would flow, and the traffickers themselves were actually beholden to the police, to the federal police. It was the police who were deciding in the 1970s and 80s how drugs would flow from Mexico into the United States, sometimes on small aircraft, Piper Cubs, that sort of thing, flying at night over the border and landing in clandestine airstrips in Texas and New Mexico, things like that. But again, it was actually the federal police who were watching that business and saying who would have the right to go and move the drugs and that sort of thing. So the traffickers were beholden to the federal police themselves, according to a number of documents that show this from the 1970s and 80s. By the 1990s, the drug trade starts to grow tremendously, and the PRI was still in power. And so there's a sense that there was this kind of, yeah, I'll turn my back and let you do your job. There must be some sort of financial kickback, and that apparently was taking place. It appears that the great sectors of Mexico's current economy are inundated by drug dollars, if you will, or drug pesos, the money that comes from the profits of illegal drugs infiltrating into the legitimate economy and mixing in such a way that some experts tell us that if you pulled that money out of Mexico's economy, you would see a collapse in certain parts of the country. The economy would simply not function without this illegal money moving about. And so there's this sense that all this did take place under the Institutional Revolutionary Party, the PRI, and there's also a perception that somehow the PRI could strike new deals and bring the country back to at least a peaceful time when, sure, illegal activities do take place, but the number of, you know, the amount of violence that we've seen would drop dramatically.
Do you think that that's a realistic assessment?
Well, the PRI says it's definitely not going to strike pacts. The candidates who opposed the PRI candidates said, wait, yeah, that's exactly what you're going to do. So this is the rhetoric that you hear back and forth. I think that personally, the power of the cartels has grown such that in some parts of the country, it's going to be tough for the federal government even to go in and have a presence. Hmm. There are places in Mexico right now where the federal police won't even enter. That's to say, they're under the full control of drug trafficking organizations who have expanded their illegal activities beyond mere drug trafficking, but now into a whole array of other illicit activities, kidnappings, extortions, car thefts, even prostitution and things of that sort. And so there's a sense that, the PRI might try to strike a deal, but the traffickers are powerful beyond what the federal government could do at this stage. So there's a perception that the kind of drug-related violence that we've seen, no matter who takes office, will prevail and continue for at least a couple more years.
And that's Frank Contreras. He's an independent reporter based in Mexico. That country is having its elections this Sunday. Contreras also reports for Al Jazeera English and for NPR, BBC, and the CBC. See in the past. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan, and I'd like to invite our listeners to join us. You can call us at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. We're wondering if you're following the elections in Mexico, and do you have questions for Frank? And if you're a Mexican national living in the U.S., are you going to vote? And where do you go to get your news and analysis on the presidential elections in Mexico? Our number again is 866-798-8255. You can also send us an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. We'll also be talking about the Supreme Court ruling on SB 1070 in Arizona. You can give us a call, 866-798-8255. Where did you see the best reporting this week? You can share it with us by sending us an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. And if you have a story that you think should be covered and isn't, you can also join our discussion. 866-798-8255. It's a toll-free number, and we've got full lines, so we'll get to those calls in just a moment. But let me go to Michael Doyle, who covers the Supreme Court for McClatchy's and also writes Suits and Sentences, the McClatchy Legal Affairs blog. So, Michael, I think most of our listeners have heard about the Supreme Court decision on what's being called Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. But can you just quickly recap it for us? What was that decision?
The decision was to uphold the law in its entirety, to uphold the individual mandate, and to uphold the directive to states to expand their Medicaid coverage. What was unexpected about the decision, one was the author of it was the Chief Justice, conservative John Roberts. Two was the reasoning used to uphold the individual mandate that was under the taxation powers of Congress. And finally, a little unexpected was that the court said while the the Obama administration cannot threaten to withhold all Medicaid funds to states that don't expand their Medicaid-served population. They can, nonetheless, withhold money used to pay for the additional population. So the 5-4 decision was a great victory, of course, for President Obama, but honestly, it was a great victory for John Roberts as well in terms of his leadership of the court.
And the New York Times, in an editorial this morning, says it's a confused opinion.
It's confusing in a couple of respects. One is the simple alliance, the unexpected strange bedfellows alliance of Justice Roberts, a conservative Republican appointed, and his four allies in this particular case were the four Democratic appointed so-called liberals on the court. So that was a twist on the normal course of events. The reasoning was not what people expected as well. The liberals on the court wanted to uphold the individual mandate under what's called the Commerce Clause of the Constitution, which gives Congress very sweeping powers. Justice Roberts wouldn't go that far. He said the Commerce Clause does not empower Congress to compel people to buy things like insurance, but he said Congress has the power under its authority to lay taxes. The significance of this, and this is in part what the New York Times and others have referred to, is that although an obvious victory for the Obama administration, the health care law survives, in the long run, this opinion will be used or could be used to short-circuit other congressional laws because the Commerce Clause has been, in essence, shortened or shrunk under the reasoning used by a majority of the court.
And Michael, CNN and Fox News initially reported inaccurately that the individual mandate had been struck down, which was what most people were assuming was going to happen. Can you take us kind of behind the scenes and tell us how you report on something so huge, hundreds of pages of a decision like this, with that huge pressure to get the story out first?
It's both a very, very entertaining, if you like, being on the high wire, and very fraught with tension. And at 10 o'clock in the Supreme Court press office, a bell rings. We're in the press office. The court is upstairs. We're listening to the justice over a loudspeaker. And decisions, there were three decisions to be issued. And the Chief Justice says, and we can hear him say, I have the opinion in the case 01175 National Federation of Business against Sebelius. And at that second, the press officers open up these gray boxes and hand out the written opinions. Then there's a mad scrum, get out of my way, as reporters rush back to their desks and they're furiously flipping through the pages. And what happened for these poor CNN and Fox producers is the first couple of pages of the opinion was Chief Justice Roberts explaining why the Commerce Clause cannot be used to justify the individual mandate. And at quick reading, under pressure, it is understandable completely to read this as, oh, the court is going to strike down the entire law. It took several pages of reading into the executive summary before you get to, on the other hand, the taxation power gives it the authority. So it was an understandable error, and not my attitude is there, but for the grace of God, go I.
And that's Michael Doyle, who covers the Supreme Court for McClatchy's. You're listening to Your Call. It's our media roundtable. I'm Holly Kernan. We're also joined by Frank Contreras, who's an independent reporter based in Mexico, and he reports for Al Jazeera English. We'll get to your calls right after this break. You can call us and join us at 866-798-8255. Where did you see the best reporting this week? You can share it with us by calling 866-798-8255. I'm Holly Kernan. You're listening to Your Call, and we'll be right back after this short break.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW. San Francisco, and our email newsletter is a great way to keep up to date with local public radio as well as find out the latest developments in non-commercial media. Every week or two, you'll get an email from us with updates on KALW programming and public events, as well as the occasional free ticket offer. And it's easy to sign up. Just click on the e-newsletter link on the homepage of KALW.org. And thank you for listening to and supporting your local public radio station, KALW San Francisco.
For those of you joining us now, I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. That's also where you can listen to past shows and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up next. On Monday, we'll be talking about the latest developments in breast cancer treatment and prevention. Today, we're having a conversation about the week's news with our panel of national and international journalists. And you can join our conversation in just a moment. We have a full bank of lines right now, but you can call us at 866-798-TALK. You can also send us an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org, and you can post comments at our new website, yourcallradio.org. That's where you'll find links to all of the stories that we're discussing today, and you can add your own stories there. That's yourcallradio.org. Today, we're talking with Michael Doyle, who covers the Supreme Court for McClatchy's. He also writes Suits and Sentences, the McClatchy Legal Affairs blog, and Frank Contreras, who's an independent reporter based in Mexico, and he's covering the elections that'll take place this weekend on Sunday. So we were talking, Michael, about the Supreme Court case in the Affordable Care Act, and it was a big surprise for most people. Did it surprise you, and is there anything in it that we should know about that hasn't been widely reported? Are you there, Michael?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes. Thank you.
Yes. The conclusion did surprise me. And I had thought that the conservative majority was going to strike down the law under the Commerce Clause, as in fact they did. What I hadn't expected was the use of the taxation power. That was a real stretch, and I should explain why. The first question for the court to face was, was it premature to consider the case? There's a 19th century law, the Anti-Injunction Act, which says you can't file a suit against a tax until the tax has been imposed. And the argument was the Obama administration said, well, this is not a tax. It's only collected on your tax return if you don't buy health insurance. And the court agreed it's not a tax for the purposes of the 19th century law. And then the court turned around and said, but it's like a tax, even though it's not called one, for the purposes of approving it under the taxation power of the Congress. And this is a case of Justice Roberts being very adroit to find a narrow way to uphold the law, but also being very aggressive in how he performs his job. He said that the court has an obligation to uphold the law as wherever possible. A court, especially a conservative court, doesn't want to be in the business of overturning an act of a democratically elected legislature. And so Justice Roberts showed that when he wants to, he can be very assertive in being deferential, so to speak. He took an assertive reading of the law in order to uphold what Congress had done. And I think that is something that will bear watching in the future because, frankly, and here some liberal groups are quite concerned that the decision in the case lays the groundwork for the court to do a whole lot of reexamining a future of laws in the future.
Can you just explain that a little bit more for us?
Sure. There are four questions for the court. And the first was, can the case be heard in the first place or was it premature? And the administration said, and the court agreed, that the argument was made that you can't bring a lawsuit against the law because it charges a tax, and there's an old 19th century law saying you can't challenge a tax until it's been imposed, and the tax has not been imposed yet. It won't be for 2 or 3 years. And the court said, this is not a tax. We can hear the case. Then they addressed the second question, can the individual mandate be upheld as a power of Congress? And there they said, well, although we said it wasn't a tax earlier, now we're going to say it is a tax, and Congress has the power to enact taxes, and so we're going to uphold the law. It's confusing because it seems like the court contradicts itself in the space of just a few pages. But the upshot of it is that this was the way that the Chief Justice found to uphold the law while still not giving the liberals the commerce power, Commerce Clause power that they had wanted.
And let's now turn to another Supreme Court ruling this week, which is on Arizona's SB 1070. Can you just recap what happened there?
Sure. On a 5-3 vote with Justice Anthony Kennedy writing the majority opinion, the court took a mixed view toward Arizona's border control law. The most controversial or most notorious provision that some call the Show Your Papers or Show Me Your Papers Act, which was upheld, and that is the provision that says law enforcement officers who stop individuals for other legitimate purposes are required to check the papers, the identity, essentially, and immigration status of the people that they stop. That was upheld for now, but it can be challenged in the future, depending how it's applied. But at the same time, the court struck down other provisions of the law that on the grounds that they interfered with the federal responsibility for immigration. These included a separate state, making it a separate state crime to be in the United States illegally or to apply for a job without proper work authorization. So the SB, the Arizona law ruling was a mixed bag. The Obama administration was challenged law, won in some instances, but the state of Arizona won on the highest profile element.
And let's go to our callers now. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan, and you just heard from Michael Doyle, who covers the Supreme Court for McClatchy Newspapers. And let's hear from Max in Berkeley. Hi, Max.
Good morning. Thank you for a good program. Thank you for taking my call, and kudos to you for your weekly review of the press.
Thank you.
Thank you. And my question is about ACA. And some people, of course, there's a lot of concern about costs and that the fact that ACA does not address that properly. But some people are arguing that what we are seeing is more and more regulation of the healthcare industry in this country. And it's going to be regulated tightly in the future. Of course, this is going to require work. And we'll end up with an industry regulated as the utility industry, telephone, energy, and what have you, is regulated in the United States. Can you speculate on that,
Michael?
Well, I would say that I don't know that there's more and more regulation of the healthcare industry. It's already one of the most extensively regulated industry in terms of licensing and standards of care and provisions of care. I mean, clearly the Affordable Care Act in its 2,700 pages imposed a whole new regime of regulations and imposed many new regulatory burdens, and that has many people concerned, including about its ability to impede freedom of choice, impede care, and to add costs. But just my instinctive reaction to the smart question is I don't know how much more regulation is actually taking place. The healthcare is the farthest thing from the free market in many respects.
And Michael, the way that the Supreme Court case in SB 1070, Arizona's immigration law, has been covered has largely been sort of, it's a political victory for Obama. It's a win. It's a loss. How do you view the coverage of this so far?
Well, first of all, my view is that it's a political victory for the administration and that they succeeded in blocking some provisions of the law they don't like. And yet, by upholding the Show Your Papers provision, the court helped mobilize the Latino electorate, which will benefit Obama. So that's my assessment of that. The coverage has been interesting to follow because, like the health care law, there's some confusing elements to the Arizona ruling, specifically in the sense of you had one provision upheld, you had three provisions struck down. Is that a win for one side? Is it a loss for the other? Is it a 50-50? Is it a 3-1 vote for Obama? You don't know quite how to weight the different provisions. And so if you go back and look at the headlines you have and the leads of stories, you'd find all over the map of whether people called it an outright defeat of the Arizona law or a political victory for the president. One thing I would just add, it's perhaps regrettable but inevitable that in this election year, every legal decision is viewed through a political lens.
Mm.
And so whether the court upholds the law is seen as a win for the president or a win for Governor Romney or so on. And I understand that. I do that myself. Sometimes it would be nice to write a legal story that has nothing to do with politics and just look at what the law is doing.
And that's Michael Doyle, who covers the Supreme Court for McClatchy's. We're also joined now by Valeria Fernandez, who is an independent journalist in Phoenix, Arizona, and she's co-producer of Two Americans. It's a documentary about Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio. Hi, Valeria.
Hi, thank you so much for having me in the show.
Yeah, great to have you with us. Well, what was your initial reaction to the Supreme Court ruling on SB 1070?
Well, you know, being here in Arizona, in Phoenix, we were waiting on it every Monday, every Thursday. You know, yes, no, everything moves so quickly, you know, that you have to, you know, there's a degree of confusion at the very beginning when the news just come out, and you want to be careful about it. The first thing I did is I just went to the state capitol where there's a group of immigrant families and activists that have been holding a vigil for several weeks. I want to talk to them and see how the decision thinking with the immigrant community. That's what I was mostly interested on. And, you know, I was expecting people to be very excited because the provision that would have made it a state crime to be here without documents was rejected by the Supreme Court. But there was an immediate reaction of concern and frustration. And what they were saying is, we are afraid now that we won't be able to call the police to report any crimes because we're worried that they're going to ask for our documents.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is that these are people that already have a practical experience of what it's like to be here in Arizona without documents. It's not like the decision is happening in a vacuum and we didn't have any immigration-related bills in the state. We have a number of legislation that's been in effect, like the employer sanctions law that's been used by the local sheriff to raid businesses and arrest workers. We have his famous or infamous sweeps in Latino neighborhoods where the deputies were pulling people over for cracked windshields and broken taillights, asking for papers. So the perception out there from this immigrant families that I was talking with is we're going to get much more of the same thing that we've been already facing, which is quite tough. Because running into the police, basically, in Arizona, many, many, many times means that if you don't have papers, you're going to end up in the jail. And once you're there, they're going to find out that you don't have papers. And that's basically a straight ticket to being deported, whether you were pulled over because you were 5 miles over the speed limit or because the police said, listen, you don't have an ID, you don't have a driver's license, because undocumented immigrants really don't have a driver's license. We really can't tell who you are, so we need to take you to the jail, you know, to, you know, get your fingerprints and the whole thing so we can make sure that you will show up for your, for your court date for speeding 5 miles.
And
so
who's getting caught up in these sweeps?
Who's caught up in this sweep?
Yeah.
Well, we have to remember that there is a pending lawsuit right now against Maricopa County Sheriff's Office that's basically alleging that racial profiling was taking place during the sweeps. So the sweeps are very broad, and there's a lot of people caught in them that are not necessarily illegally in the country. They are U.S. citizens, mm-hmm. or there are people that have some form of an immigration status. They have a visa. They have a green card. You know, there's been a concern on the part of the Latino community, not only those that don't have documents, but the ones that are here legally, that they're going to be targeted by this provision, SB 1070, that will take effect soon, because we have a past history with the sheriff's sweeps that opened the doors for a lawsuit. And, you know, all the plaintiffs in the lawsuits are either U.S. citizens or people that are here legally. So there's that implication, too, when you look at the broader population. I was just checking the statistics. We have over 1 million Latinos just in Maricopa County. That's quite a large number of people. And there is a concern from that community that they're, you know, they're going to be harassed or that they're going to be targeted because of the color of their skin or the way they speak.
And has it gotten people active? Devised and politicized and ready to take action?
Yes, I mean, most certainly. We have to remember that SB 1070 became law about 2 years ago, and some portions were, you know, enjoined by the federal courts. But this community had 2 years to sort of process what it all means, and there was a lot of organizing immediately. And one of the main things that has been done is voter registration and civic engagement. So you've seen a lot of these young kids that don't have documents be sort of the engine and the force to mobilize other people that are here legally in the Kimbo to participate in the political process. And I think one of the biggest things that happened last year was the recall of Senator Russell Pierce, the architect of SB 1070. So that's a very tangible result, I think. You can't disconnect his recall to passage of SB 1070. They're both strongly connected. So we're hoping, or we're respecting, actually, I should say, to see more of that, because we are in the middle of an election year, and Sheriff Joe Arpaio is running for re-election, and he's sort of the next target by this movement of pro-immigrant activists and people to get him out of office, because they see him as, in a way, one of the main political forces for SB 1070. I know I could talk about this for hours, but I want to highlight something that I think is really interesting. The federal government a few years back decided to take away this 287G agreement with the sheriff's office that they had given him. And basically what the 287G agreements do is that they allow the local police to act as immigration agents. They realized that by giving this power to the sheriff deputies, they were opening the doors to a lot of allegations of racial profiling and civil rights violations. So they suspended that agreement. Just a few days after they canceled that agreement, Sheriff Joe Arpaio, Senator Russell Pierce, the architect of SB 1070, and our former county attorney, held a press conference to announce what eventually became SB 1070. So it's really interesting that the roots of SB 1070, there is a connection to the sheriff's agency, and the fact that the federal government decided to take away these powers. And this was sort of like a conservative backlash saying, okay, fine, if the federal government wants to take away these powers from us, we're going to pass our own bill, and we're going to do it the Arizona way.
Mm. That's Valeria Fernandez. She's an independent journalist in Phoenix, Arizona. We're also joined by Michael Doyle, who covers the Supreme Court for McClatchy's. And you're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. Let me invite our listeners to join our conversation about the week's news. Where did you see great coverage this week? Or is there a story that should be covered and isn't getting enough coverage? Join our conversation at 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. We were also talking about the Mexican election coming this Sunday earlier, and if you're a Mexican national living in the U.S., are you going to vote? And where do you go to get your news and analysis about the elections in Mexico? And we're talking about the Supreme Court ruling on Arizona's SB 1070. What do you think about the coverage of Arizona? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. That's a toll-free number, 866-798-TALK. And let's go to Sasha in San Francisco. Hi, Sasha.
I actually have two. I have one, which is something I think was covered well, and one that I didn't see enough of. And so the first was, it's about the Fast and Furious program.
Mm-hmm.
It's the Fortune magazine, and it's a woman named Catherine Eban, E-B-A-N. And she actually, I mean, the accepted storyline is that ATF agents let guns go into Mexico. And one of the things that she found in interviewing ATF agencies and exploring the laws in Arizona is that, in fact, there's no way they could have prevented it. That it actually isn't illegal to be a straw purchaser there. That means people could go in and buy large amounts of guns and then turn around and hand them off to other people. And that's, in fact, what happened, and that the ATF agents actually could not stop it. And so it was a really interesting article, and this is the Fortune magazine, and it's Catherine Eban.
We'll be sure to put that at our website.
Just a completely different angle on the story that just kind of is different than what the accepted kind of idea is. And so that was the first that I thought was done really well. And then the second, which I didn't see enough on, was a Supreme Court ruling that came down last week of Knox v. SEIU, which said that union members have to actually opt in to pay dues to do political spending. So in order for a union, I think, in my understanding, and again, this is, I haven't heard enough on it, and maybe the gentleman that covers this, the Supreme Court, can talk a little bit about that, because my understanding is that this ruling says that union members have to actually opt in and say, yes, I will pay money for a political ad, whereas the same thing won't apply to stockholders.
Gotcha. Okay, Sasha.
Those were my two.
Thank you so much, and we'll put a link to the Fast and Furious article in Fortune magazine, and it may be a topic that we should spend a whole hour on. In any case, I'll bring that up at our editorial meeting. Michael, did you want to talk about that Knox versus SEIU decision that Sasha brought up?
Yeah, it's an excellent point, and I completely agree. It's a very undercovered decision. In essence, it arose out of California involving an election campaign of several years ago, and Service Employees International Union wanted to raise money for political campaigns. And under the current law, or perhaps now the former law, union members had to be notified when dues were being raised or money was being raised for political purposes, and they had the option to opt out. So you would affirmatively tell the union, I don't want my money being spent for political purposes. In what could have been a fairly technical case challenging the notification requirements, the conservative majority of the court, written by Samuel Alito, had a one or two sentence, almost throwaway lines, saying that instead of opting out, union members must opt in, so that the burden is on the union member to declare they want their money used for political purposes. So the burden shifts. It used to, under the old law or under the old rule or the old presumption, the burden is on the union member who didn't want to be involved with politics. Now the new rule appears to say the burden is on the union member who wants his money raised for political purposes. This sparked a really incendiary dissent by the liberal minority, and as well as a concurring dissent by Justice Breyer, who agreed with aspects of the ruling but was just bitterly opposed to this change in the rule. It's unclear to me exactly how this will manifest itself in future union elections. It'll probably have to be litigated, but I would definitely recommend that readers and listeners find out more about the Knox case, because it was a undercovered and potentially really far-reaching decision.
Well, thank you so much for that. That's Michael Doyle. He covers the Supreme Court for McClatchy's, and he also writes Suits and Sentences, the McClatchy Legal Affairs blog. Michael, are you able to stay with us for the next 4 minutes of the show, or do you need to go?
Yeah, no, that's good. That's fine.
Fabulous. A listener writes, Lee in Berkeley writes, in an excellent piece on Mexico's most powerful traffickers, the Snow Kings of Mexico, PR Keefe explicates and exposes the history and methods of these phenomenally successful kingpins. And Sunday's New York Times Magazine, I guess this was in Sunday's New York Times Magazine on the 17th of June, here's only one of many relevant points made. Drug cartel, as it turns out, is a whopper of a misnomer. Neither the Mexicans nor the Colombians ever colluded to fix prices or supply. I wish they were, says Mexico's ambassador in Washington. If they were, they wouldn't be fighting and driving up the violence. So we'll also put a link to that article and all of the other articles we've mentioned at yourcallradio.org. And let's go back to Valeria. You made this documentary, Two Americans, about Sheriff Joe Arpaio in Arizona. Can you tell us a little bit about your movie, your film?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, this is a film that started about 4 years ago. So it documents, it's very contemporary because it really helps the audience understand how we got to where we are here in Arizona. As you know, Sheriff Joe Arpaio is now the subject of several investigations, some of them are civil. He's actually facing a lawsuit for allegations of civil rights violations, but also he remains the target of a criminal investigation by the FBI on allegations of abuse of power. So the film sort of fleshes out that history, but really gets inside the office of Sheriff Joe Arpaio, and it's just fantastic. I mean, I'm working with another director. His name is Daniel DeVivo. He goes behind the scenes with Arpaio and literally gets this man that's so used to being in front of a camera off script, and that's very revealing. Now, the film is called Two Americans. There's another American in the story, and she is a 9-year-old daughter of undocumented immigrants. Her name is Catherine Figueroa, and this is the story, the real story of how she struggles to keep her parents in the United States after they are arrested while they're working at a local car wash by sheriff deputies. So it's really moving, I think, to juxtapose these two very different worlds, you know, to go from the office of Sheriff Arpaio to his sweeps in the streets to a park where Catherine Figueroa is talking about how she feels that even though she was born in the United States, she still fears that she can be deported because she is internalizing a rejection. And so this is a story of many, many other children. And in Arizona, it really is sort of a David and Goliath tale. But what is amazing for us, and it was a beautiful experience, was to have so much access to the family, to really be able to go with them through this journey. What it means, you know, to have to struggle to go through the criminal system as an undocumented immigrant, to be accused of working with false documents, to have to, you know, fundraise your money to get out of immigration custody, to this day, the struggle to remain in the United States with your child. And the flip side of it is, you know, Arpaio's battle, you know, to stay in power as, you know, all these investigations and all these allegations are crumbling down.
And that film is called Two Americans. It's a documentary about Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio. You just heard from Valeria Fernandez, who's an independent journalist in Arizona. And I'm sorry, we're going to have to leave it there because we're out of time. We've also been joined by Michael Doyle, who covers the Supreme Court for McClatchy's and also writes Suits and Sentences, the McClatchy Legal Affairs blog. Earlier, we were joined by Frank Contreras from Mexico. We'll put a link to all of the stories and more of the week's media coverage at our website, yourcallradio.org. I'm sorry we couldn't get to all of your calls and emails. Thank you to everyone who joined us. I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. Here's what's coming up tomorrow. What do we know about breast cancer prevention? On the next Your Call, we'll talk about breast cancer and the current scientific thoughts on reducing risk. According to the Breast Cancer Fund, avoiding certain environmental toxins that show up in food and household items can be part of a prevention strategy. What else do you want to know about breast cancer research? Join us at 10 or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. What measures do you take to prevent cancer? It's Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast or newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. You can also friend us on Facebook. Ali Budner and Malihe Razazan produce the show. Matt Martin is executive producer. Becca Hoekstra is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Alan Farley is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
Coming up on the next Tavis Smiley Show from PRI, the ruling is, of course, in, and the health care law stands. We'll discuss the court's decision and break down the historic verdict. Also, we'll continue our series, Too Important to Fail, A Day in the Life Of, and Bill Banfield is back with his latest essays of note on the next Tavis Smiley Show from PRI.
The Tavis Smiley Show coming up in an hour at 12 o'clock here on KALW, San Francisco, 91.7, your local public radio station. Our next program from the BBC World Service is World Have Your Say. And then following Tavis at noon, it's Tavis Smiley and Cornel West at 1 o'clock. Stay tuned to KALW San Francisco. It is 11 o'clock.
Hello, I'm Ben James. Welcome to the Global Conversation on the BBC's World Have Your Say.
We are sticking firmly to our clear plan. We have achieved something important here and remained true to our philosophy.
Following the overnight bailout deal to once again help Europe's struggling nations, how do Germans see their future in the Eurozone? Do they feel a responsibility to look after the rest, or is it time for them to go it alone? You can email worldhaveyoursay@bbc.com to speak to our German guests coming up. Also,
I'm sorry I couldn't carry the ball over the finish line, but man, I did try.
After Anne Curry's tearful goodbye from NBC's Today Show, is it ever okay to cry at work? You can call our new phone number to take part in the conversation. Country code 442031 624242.
BBC News with David Austin. Egypt's president-elect Mohamed Morsi from the Muslim Brotherhood has taken an informal oath of office before tens of thousands of supporters in Tahrir Square in Cairo. Mr. Morsi declared that there was no power above people power, telling the crowd that they were now the source of sovereignty and authority in Egypt. Here's our Cairo correspondent, John Lyne.
Egypt's new president-to-be appeared behind the presidential seal of office on a podium in Tahrir Square, the heart of the revolution. As he got into his stride, Mohamed Morsi pushed aside the phalanx of security men in their dark glasses, took a microphone into his hand and spoke to the crowd directly. He owed all his authority to them, he stressed. Then he opened his jacket to show that he was not wearing a bulletproof vest, to tell the crowd he was not afraid of them. A day before the official ceremony, he swore an oath of office before the people who brought him to power.
The UN cultural body UNESCO has approved a Palestinian bid to grant World Heritage status to the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem. UNESCO voted in favour of adding the church, considered the birthplace of Jesus, despite Israeli objections. Here's our West Bank correspondent, John Donison.
Bethlehem's Church of the Nativity and its pilgrimage route are among the holiest sites in Christianity. An estimated 2 million people visit every year. The sites will now have World Heritage status, entitling them to United Nations funding and protection. UNESCO delegates voted 13-6 in favour of the Palestinian bid. Palestinians will see this as a small but significant victory. Last year, UNESCO became the first UN body to officially accept Palestine as a member state.
The German Chancellor Angela Merkel has been defending a deal agreed with other Eurozone leaders to restore financial stability. The agreement allows struggling banks to receive money directly from Eurozone bailout funds, something originally opposed by Germany. Here's our Brussels correspondent Chris Morris.
A single supervisory body for Eurozone banks will be set up by the end of this year under the auspices of the European Central Bank. Once that's done, Germany has agreed that further measures can be taken to help countries like Italy and Spain. Struggling banks will have access to Eurozone bailout funds, without the money being routed through governments and increasing sovereign debts. The same funds will also be used to buy bonds of countries that are facing high borrowing costs, without those countries having to apply for a formal bailout.
The aid agency Oxfam says people in the Democratic Republic of Congo are so fed up with the looting of their food by armed men that they've stopped trying to produce a surplus to sell. It quotes farmers as saying there's no point growing extra food because it'll be stolen. Oxfam said a large part of eastern Congo was almost completely lawless. This is the world news from the BBC. Gunmen in Kenya have killed one person in the Dadaab refugee camp in the north of the country and kidnapped at least four international aid workers. The attackers ambushed a convoy belonging to the aid agency Norwegian Refugee Council as it drove through the camp, which houses some 500,000 Somalis. The dead person is reported to be a Kenyan driver working for the aid agency. The WikiLeaks founder, Julian Assange, has made clear through his spokeswoman that he will continue to seek political asylum in Ecuador. Last week, he entered the Ecuadorian embassy in London. Here's Angus Crawford.
Julian Assange cannot set foot outside the embassy because, having broken the terms of his bail, he's liable to arrest. Police issued a surrender notice requiring him to report to a police station at 11:30 today. A spokesman for Mr. Assange said the 40-year-old was in good spirits but had declined the request, though he said that was not a sign of disrespect. He claims if sent back to Sweden, he faces questioning over allegations of rape and sexual assault. He believes he might then also be extradited to the US.
The opposition Democratic Party in Mongolia is claiming victory in an election fought on how to redistribute newfound wealth generated by a mining boom. The BBC's Michael Cohn reports from Ulaanbaatar.
The Democrats ran on a platform that emphasized high taxes on companies that export coal, saying that the money raised from this tax would be used to improve infrastructure in suburban areas that lack sewage, electricity, and running water. Voters also supported a plan by the Democrats to distribute free land to every citizen. The immediate challenge for the Democrats will be the formation of a coalition government with one of the smaller parties in parliament.
Officials in northeastern India say 43 people have died in flooding and landslides. About a million people in Assam have been forced to flee their homes. The floods, caused by heavy monsoon rains, are the worst for more than a decade. BBC News.
We've heard the news from the BBC. Now it's your turn.
You can post on facebook.com/worldhaveyoursay or get in touch via Twitter at @BBC_WHYS.
Welcome to World Have Your Say.
Hello there, welcome. Well, what a long night it was for Angela Merkel in Brussels. She says the latest deal agreed for the future of the Eurozone was a good compromise, with its close supervision of European banks and safeguards for taxpayers' money, she says. But it also means European bailout funds paid into by taxpayers across the Eurozone will now be allowed to assist troubled banks directly, something previously opposed by Germany. Well, a long night has turned into a long day. The German parliament is debating the agreement right now. Let's hear a bit of it.
Dass diese Wettbewerbsfähigkeit, dass man Produkte produzieren kann, die man absetzen kann.
And I can see one of the deputies there making some kind of passionate speech, and some of the other deputies just applauding him. We'll dip into a little of more of what they're saying later in the programme. So what should Germany's place in the Eurozone be? Does it have a responsibility to help countries struggling? Or should it cut and run before all the other nations drag it down? We're going to hear Germans talking to each other about how they see it. You can call them now on our brand new phone number. It's country code 44 20 31 62 42 40.
World Have Your Say has a new phone number. If you want to get in touch, call country code +44 20 31 62 42 42.
Yes, we've been saying our phone number over and over again to try and make it sink in. Let's tell you it one more time in case you got so used to the old one that you've got that saved into your phone. To call us now, it's country code 44 20 31 62 42 42, and as always, we will call you straight back so you can get your point right onto the programme here on World Have Your Say. Let me introduce you then to some of our German guests. Professor William Hankel's with us. He's not too far from Cologne in Germany. Konstantinos Fischer's here as well. He's a German now living in Crete in Greece. Welcome to both of you, gentlemen.
Hello.
Hello. Professor Hankel, let me please start with you and just give us your take on, I guess, your reaction to the latest deal thrashed out by your Chancellor.
I am one of the complainants against the new treaty for ESM, and my